You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Lillian Hanley tōku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 17th of June. My name is Lillian and yes, I'll be with you for the next hour yet again. I'm back, but only for a few weeks. Thanks so much to Bronnie for covering last week. She'll be the new Wednesday Wire host next month, ideally, all going well, considering exams and everything going on. Yes. And she'll be a very capable and intelligent host. Welcome, Alan and Felix, who are in studio with me. How are you both?
G'day, I'm good.
Yeah.
Alan's all right.
Interesting times.
Giving me sad faces. I gotta go. One day. We also have Rick in studio, just letting everybody know, because we've got some system updates happening. So we're going to roll with that, and I'm using different buttons, which are strange, but that's okay. Let's move on to the show, which we have a big one today. Of course, Dear Science, we revisit the ever controversial hydroxychloroquine issue yet again, and we talk about electricity being created from shadows, and that there may possibly be 36 civilizations out in space that we could contact. Felix has followed up on his piece from last week, speaking to Auckland's head of community libraries for North and West, Daryl Soljan, about the role of libraries in the community. Finally, we have New Zealand First's Tracy Martin back on the show consistently and ongoing, which is great. And today we speak extensively about systemic racism in Crown institutions. Don't forget, you can catch all of these stories and more on the 95BFM website. And if you want to share your thoughts with us, tuku pātou mai, you can text us on 5395 Waimairane. Give us a call in studio on 309 3879. But let us begin.
Oh wow, it's time for Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
Okay, that semi worked. We got it. All right, Rick, you do your thing. Ellen, you do your thing.
Hey, I went to MOTAT on Sunday.
Did you? How was
it? Yes, we took our 3-year-old grandnephew there.
Grandnephew.
Hey. Or great nephew, I'm not sure.
Grandnephew,
whatever.
That's cute.
And I've never seen a kid, damn near wet himself. He had so much fun. The big planes, he thought it was so cool.
It's so cool.
Well done, MOTAT.
Not even saying that because of...
Yeah, you know, no.
But it's a great place.
Really, really cool. Right, what are we going to talk about today?
Hydroxychloroquine.
My goodness me. It just never goes away, does it? Now, regular listeners, will know that last time I was on, we were talking about hydroxychloroquine, and... at that stage, there was a paper in the very eminent medical journal, The Lancet, which said that not only is it no good for fighting COVID-19, it also is positively dangerous in some respects. And so therefore, on the basis of this paper, the World Health Organization had basically stopped all investigations into hydroxychloroquine because this paper said, nah, it's bad. You know, it's potentially bad.
Okay.
Now, in the intervening 2 weeks, this paper has been withdrawn from the literature, which is kind of unusual. Yeah, and it's not very good. So there were a few warning signs there. People obviously missed them. But the guts of it is that this paper was written by people at a company called Surgisphere. And this company purported to have obtained hospital records from around about at least 1,000 hospitals worldwide who were treating COVID-19 patients. They had got all of their patient data, basically, and they had analysed it and written the paper. Okay, now that sounds
decent.
Sort of eminently reasonable. Until a little bit of sleuthing on behalf of a number of people, including The Guardian over in the UK. And then basically what they found was that this company had six employees, one of whom was a sci-fi author, fantasy artist, and another one was a quote, adult model, unquote.
Hey.
And was run by a guy by the name of Sapan Desai, okay? And So this immediately sort of casts doubt on the whole thing, because there's no way in the world that you can get a company with six employees to liaise with thousands, you know, over 1,000 hospitals all around the world, get all of their patient data in all of the different formats that it was, put it into the one format, analyze it, blah de blah de blah, etc.
It's just not.
So it just ain't going to happen. And so that sort of sent everything into a bit of a tailspin. And so this company, Surgisphere, claimed to have all of these collaborations with places around the world, big universities, big hospitals. So places like Stanford, University of Minnesota, University of Utah, University of Glasgow, they were all on the website of Surgisphere as collaborators and you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, the press then went to those places and said, do you know this Surgisphere? And then just said, no, we haven't had any collaboration. We don't know who these people are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Extremely, extremely awkward. And especially, as I said, because the World Health Organization, on the basis of that Lancet paper, said, right, we're going to stop all investigations into hydroxychloroquine. So as a result of that, once the paper was retracted and all of these sort of things came up, they then said, okay, well, shit, let's restart these,
because there's
no evidence, there's no verified evidence out there that this is potentially harmful. So we'd might as well keep studying it. And so they restarted their studies. And then just overnight, in fact, or yesterday, the US FDA, so the Food and Drug Administration, came out and said, right, so this we're going to remove our emergency approval of hydroxychloroquine. We're not going to be studying this anymore. And now there's actual out there verified data saying that no, it doesn't do a damn thing. That's not necessarily saying that it's nasty or anything like that, but verified data for, you know, using real bloody clinical studies and all of that stuff now is out there. And this was just a
Should I say it? A shit show.
I was going to say
okay,
something I'm really not allowed to say.
Well,
cluster, but yeah.
Well, but I suppose what this is pointing out is the importance of verified data.
That's fundamental here.
Not the fact that Trump finally has been proven wrong, but that there is a process in which has to be undertaken before.
You're absolutely right. There is a process, and obviously, now the main problem with COVID-19 is that it just took everybody by surprise, basically. And, you know, everything had to be done in a very, very short period of time. So all of these studies, et cetera, have been done under constraints of time that just don't normally apply in normal situations. And so, you know, everything perhaps is a bit of a rush job with all of this sort of stuff. And sadly, it seems, and I have to be careful saying this because, you know, libelous and all that sort of stuff, but it just seems like somebody might have taken advantage of this, you know, this very, very short time
period.
For what gain? I have no idea. Okay. Honestly, I really don't understand it.
For
surely you would think that they knew that they were going to get caught out on this, surely. And, you know, with something as earth-shattering, literally, as COVID-19. So, you know, this paper, when it was published, was going to be subject to the most extraordinary scrutiny. Hmm. It just was always going to be. So how the hell anybody ever thought that they were going to get away with this for the sake of a paper in the world's, you know, possibly best, you know, medical journal? Bloody hell.
Okay.
It just defies logic. It really, really does.
Do you want to add anything on that, or shall we just leave it there until the next time we have to talk about it?
No, the latest thing is some, I was reading it this morning, some drug that they think might prolong the life of patients on ventilators, and it's just a very simple, it was an antibiotic or something, I can't remember, but
in order to then... you have more time to recover.
No, I think it's a sort of a recovery thing. I think they're sort of saying that 1 in 8 of the people on the ventilators recovered when they were taking this stuff.
Alrighty.
Boy, but let's just get rid of this goddamn virus, eh?
Yes, indeed. Jeez,
honestly.
And shall we move into talking now about some positive news?
Indeed.
Some electricity being made.
No pun intended. I like that. Positive? Very good. Very good. Okay, so...
I didn't even realise I was doing that, I'll be honest.
Never admit that. So, Shadows. Shadows and Shadows
not
and Light.
Not the bar.
Shadows and Light. Great Joni Mitchell album, that. Shadows and Light. There, I'm segueing nicely into everyone knows who Joni Mitchell is, hopefully. So, Shadows are not pretty... Well, you'd think they're probably not great for generating electricity. We go on about solar power and stuff like that, and obviously solar power is a brilliant thing. The one thing you kind of need for it is light.
Light. Energy.
Yep, okay. And the way that it works kind of is, you know, you've got your silicon-based solar cells and they absorb the light and that kicks up electrons from a valence band into a conduction band across the Fermi level and blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah, and you get electricity like that. And you'd think shadows would sort of play no part in the generation of electricity, but these guys at the National University of Singapore have just published a paper, which I think is really, really cool, where they are basically taking these silicon, sort of silicon solar cells, and they put a very, very, very thin coating of gold on them. Okay, now that doesn't sound particularly, you know, non-expensive, shall we say. But what then seems to happen is that you get a different method of electricity generation in these. So your solar cells absorb the light, they kick an electron actually from the silicon to the gold. This is the big difference.
Okay.
And this device, now, if you put one half of it in the light and one half of it in the shade, then the bit that's in the shade, it's not getting those electrons kicked up. The other ones are getting them kicked up into the gold, and that creates a potential difference, which is otherwise known as a voltage. And once you've got a voltage and some electrons, then you get the flow of electric current. Okay? And this relies on part of your device being in the light and part of the device being in the dark. That's what actually generates the voltage, and that's really, really seriously cool.
Very cool.
And so they are thinking, well, you know, we can use this now in places where you have shadows. So you don't have to have direct sunlight for this to work. And in fact, the device that they've built at the moment works 200% better than silicon solar cells do in shadows. So, you know, when it's cloudy up there and stuff like that, you know, the silicon-based solar cells don't work brilliantly. And this one does, because it's just relying on the difference, on the contrast between light and shadow. Now, obviously, the greater the contrast, the greater the current. The bigger the voltage, the greater the current, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. At the moment, they're just in the sort of, you know, very, very early stages, as they often are when I talk about these things, you know.
That's all good.
The changing the world is, you know, years down the track sort of thing. But they've actually got it to power, you know, small electrical devices.
Brilliant.
Doing this. And I think it's just amazing. Who the hell thought of doing that?
So is it a bit more, like, consistent than solar panels?
Well, again, it's depending on the difference between the light and the dark, so the difference in the amount between the light and the shade. So if you've got, as I say, it's going to work best when, you know, you're sort of cloudy or whatever and you don't have so much light, because it just sort of inherently works better in shady conditions. So
maybe it could work alongside solar panels, so that once that light does get dimmer and therefore the solar panels don't work, like you say, Felix, as well, you have the substitute come in,
which is...
Because this is one of the issues, I think, around that kind of green energy or renewable energy, right, and this idea that we want to put lots more investment into solar, for example, but because solar isn't reliable 24/7, they have to run coal or whatever it is in the area to also back up the system in case
Or they need better batteries.
Right.
That's the big thing, you know, batteries. You've got to make fantastic batteries.
Yeah.
Somehow, if you can store all of the stuff that you're generating during daylight
then
hours,
then
you're laughing.
So
That's where they're putting the money into, and creating better solar cells as well. So this is all part of that. And look, shit, this is where the future of humanity lies in solar power. It just is. Mm. You know, forget fossil fuels, forget burning coal, forget all of that stuff. You know, 100 years from now, they'll look back and laugh at what we did, very probably, because they'll have all of this stuff sorted. So... And there'll be the chemists that do it, of course.
All right, let's touch on our final story. And this is the possibility of 36 civilizations in outer space. I feel like you're a bit skeptical on this one, Alan.
Yeah, well, I thought the answer to life, the universe and everything was 42, according to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
As in there are 42.
No.
Just 42.
Just 42.
Okay.
You haven't read the book?
No, sorry.
Oh, you've got a treat ahead of you, I'll tell you that. It's a very good book. Right, so obviously you look out in the stars at night and you think, right, what are the chances? How many alien civilizations are there out there? Are we the only ones, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So in 1961, a fellow by the name of Drake came up with the eponymous named equation, the Drake equation, and he sort of put everything together in terms of probabilities of life existing in our galaxy, the Milky Way, okay, which is, remember, one of only a squillion galaxies out in the universe, okay? Now, at the risk of sounding really dull, okay, so this equation, you've got the number, the average number of stars formed per year, multiplied by the fraction of those that can form planets, multiplied by the fraction of those that can support life, multiplied by the fraction of those that actually form life, multiplied by the fraction of those that develop intelligent life forms, multiplied by the fraction of those that develop technology, multiplied by the average lifetime of a communicating species. There we go.
Wow.
So we've got seven factors in the Drake equation, basically. And we only know the answer to the first one of those.
Gosh.
everything else is a guess, basically.
Wow.
So roughly, apparently, there are seven or so planets formed in our galaxy every year. And all of those other fractions, so the, you know, the fraction of, you know, planets and blah, 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 that can support life, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And people have looked at this over many years and they've, and they've come up with estimates for the answer to this particular problem from zero to all the way to a few billion, okay?
Whoa.
Which is kind of, you know, a bit broad. So wanting to get a little bit better estimate on this, so there's workers at Nottingham, University of Nottingham, and they've made some sort of assumptions, and most of the assumptions are sort of based on the fact that any planet that's going to be able to support life and support intelligent life and lead to quote-unquote civilization, all that sort of stuff, is going to be sort of Earth-like, sort of in size and in distance from the sun and all of that sort of thing, you know, the Goldilocks zone, as they call it, sort of thing. And on the basis of those assumptions, they have narrowed down the Drake equation from zero to a few billion to now 4 and 211.
Okay.
And the most probable number seems to be 36. They reckon that there's 36 possible civilizations out there in our galaxy, in the Milky Way. And remember, the Milky Way is made up of somewhere between 100 and 400 billion stars, you know, each of which have got, you know, God knows how many associated planets going around them, et cetera, et cetera. So of all of that, then 36 seems to be the number.
I feel like there's definitely more than 36. It's a very small number.
And yeah, you say I'm a bit skeptical. Yeah, it does seem to be your very sort of educated guesses sort of the whole way through. But, you know, my pig ignorant view of all of this is there's got to be something else
out there. Of course.
There just has to be. It's not a very scientific viewpoint, but there just has to be.
But I think it's fair to say it's pretty huge.
But anyway, so this is the, you know, this is the finest minds on the planet. So,
brilliant.
You know, doing all this stuff, and there we go.
We've got a couple of questions, Alan. Someone's saying, where is the research being done and who by around that solar, the gold?
National University of Singapore.
Thank
NUS.
You very much.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
Also, someone just saying, what about Nikola Tesla free power from AC Earth?
Yeah. Oh, Tesla. Okay. Yeah.
And then finally,
Tesla was brilliant, but he was a bit of a loony, I think. He was amazing guy. Yeah,
someone asking, I feel Trump just wants to be thrown out and keeps doing more outrageous things. On that note, what are symptoms of Adderall addiction?
Ooh, you're asking the wrong person there.
All right. Well, let's leave it there then.
My goodness, questions.
Thank
there we go.
You so much, Alan,
Fantastic.
For coming in as usual.
Always a pleasure.
We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Shall do. Take it easy.
Being in the dark about your KiwiSaver is no big deal, right? It's just money. A few dollars. A few $100,000. Who needs to retire? On the other hand, you could talk to Coda Wealth. Their 100% Kiwi-owned and operated KiwiSaver scheme is personalised for you, so you get the retirement you deserve. Ethical investments and some of the lowest fees in the industry. Shine a light on your future with Koura Wealth. Visit kourawealth.co.nz today. That's K-O-U-R-A wealth.co.nz.
Discover the diversity of science at the Royal Photographic Society Science Photographer of the Year exhibition, on now at MOTAT. For the first time outside of London, 47 intriguing images of science in action. Entry included with general admission. Go to motat.nz.
Has this ever happened to you?
All right, Brent, I've warned you before about that tie. You're sacked. And don't go screaming to HR either, because they're sacked too. I would have sacked you months ago, Brent, but your landlord's a friend of mine and I'd hate to see him out of pocket. Now get out.
Get to know your rights on Red Dead Redemption. Every Monday at 8 on 95BFM Breakfast with Auckland Union representative Justine Sachs. Red Dead Redemption. Monday mornings only on 95BFM.
Classic journal question as well. Can I have a jaw?
The Wire.
Last week I reported on some of the ways that libraries are evolving and supporting people as we move forward from lockdown, including job-seeking support and providing access to digital technologies. As a follow-up to that, I decided to talk to somebody who's a hell of a lot more qualified to talk about libraries than I am, Auckland's head of Community Libraries North and West, Daryl Soljan. I first wanted to ask about the recently announced funding boost and how that $60 million investment actually translates on a practical level.
There's still quite a lot of detail to be worked through, is my understanding. The bulk of it is targeted around things involving the National Library and the National Archive. But at the same time, there is going to be a chunk available to help public libraries. Of course, Auckland's the largest public library network in New Zealand, and we're our manager of libraries information is talking with the manager of National Libraries about how best to approach things. We think that it's likely to assist, from an Auckland context, it's likely to assist with some of the things that are kind of universal across New Zealand, so things like interloans. So at the moment, if we don't have a book in our collection that someone from Auckland wants and it happened to be in, say, Palmerston North, then we pay to get that transferred up to here and often pass the cost on to the customer. So my understanding is that something like the interloans will be something that will be helped with. We think there's some good opportunities to request that some of the funding might be used to help some of our rural libraries in Auckland. So we've got 11 rural libraries which tend to look after the outer extremities, particularly up towards the Waitakere Ranges, also Rodney in the far north and Franklin in the south. So there may be some opportunities to support the volunteers to a greater extent than we can do at the moment at those rural libraries.
That's
but
great.
But certainly, $60 million, regardless of whether it's Auckland Libraries or another library, it's fantastic recognition from the department and from the minister and from the government about the important role libraries play in New Zealand.
That investment's also going towards things you may not expect a library to handle, such as support for job seekers who may be struggling to write a new CV or who haven't applied to a job before. Alongside that, Daryl told me about some of the ways that libraries make technology more accessible to people.
An important thing that librarians do is we can sit down with people and help them build their own CV and help them do some of these things. So many of us take it for granted that we can use a computer, that we know what a CV should look like, that we have a good grasp of language, that we have access to the internet. You know, a lot of these people, you know, you try to apply for a job these days without emailing your application or attaching it or entering it via some sort of internet portal. So I think a lot of us forget that there's a real barrier, that not everyone in New Zealand has an internet connection, and not everyone in New Zealand has a device. So we provide the devices, the access to the internet and the expertise. And I remember one story not that long ago of a Māori gentleman who had relocated with his family from the far north to Auckland and turned up at one of our libraries and just really didn't know where to start. Obviously wanted to apply for jobs, but never put together a CV before, had never used a computer before. And so our staff were able to help him put his CV together and a cover letter and submit it via one of our public computers. And then about a month later, that gentleman came back to the library thanking the staff that for the first time in 3 years, he had a job and he really felt good about being a husband and a father and a provider for his family. And that's just one example. And we do that every day with throughout our 55 libraries in Auckland.
That's really lovely. Have you seen many people coming in for that kind of support recently since you opened up after the lockdown?
Anecdotally, people are starting to drift into libraries to seek that help. I mean, I forget too. You know, I don't know about you, Felix. I don't even have a printer at home anymore. So you know, sometimes I have to use the library to do print. You know, if we want to print a CV. So we have definitely got people coming into the libraries seeking help. And one, because libraries keep a bit of a low profile, I guess not a lot of people realise that every single day of the year in Auckland, 35,000 people walk through one of our doors. So there was great excitement at Auckland the week and the weekend when for the first time in 10 years there was 40-odd thousand people at Eden Park to watch a game of footy. You know, we have 35,000 people every single day of the year coming through our doors to borrow items, to seek help and advice, and to be able to access the world of information and the world in general.
That level of accessibility is really important as the world continues to develop technology and rely on IT for more things. I wanted to talk to Daryl about how libraries continue to provide that accessibility as IT becomes more important for day-to-day tasks and what forms libraries might take in the future. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the ways that like various things are becoming more IT-dependent, like job applications or the IRD or banks.
Yes, certainly. I mean, even here at Auckland Council, so at the moment, a really big opportunity, civic opportunity, is to provide feedback on the emergency budget. So I know that as of this morning, we've had over 30,000 pieces of feedback at Council, and that closes midnight Friday. I would be guessing that probably 95% of that 30,000 pieces of feedback have come through digital channels. We obviously make sort of hard copy available at places like libraries and customer service centres, but it's much easier for people to sit at home and spend 10-15 minutes providing feedback through the digital channel than it is to sit down, write on a hard copy, put it in an envelope, go somewhere, buy a stamp, put it in the letterbox and send it off. And so that's, I think, one of our jobs. And you mentioned some other things too, Felix. So, you know, trying to apply for a rental property, trying to apply for a job, trying to access various funding through government. That's all very, very difficult and time-consuming for people if they have to use non-digital channels. So you can imagine, you know, if you're a person working at two jobs to make ends meet for your family, you haven't got time to stand at a government department place somewhere waiting in a queue to have your rental application processed or your driver's license processed or whatever it might be. You know, it's a lot faster and a lot easier for those with digital means.
I'm also curious about some of the ways that libraries provide options for people who are maybe vision impaired or hearing impaired or otherwise unable to access information in the same way that other people do.
Yeah, that's right, Felix. That whole, you know, we work on a universal access principle. So when we design things like our website, for example, we use those universal access principles. We work with the Blind Foundation. We work with the Deaf Foundation, and we, you know, it's not always possible to provide absolutely equal access, but we do work hard, as do other libraries around the world, to be able to provide those resources. So for people who have sight issues, we have apart from designing things like the website so that they can access them through their digital readers, which convert them into words and sound. For our deaf, for our blind customers, we have a lot of e-resources around audiobooks, and you know, we work closely with those other agencies to try and keep improving what we provide for those people and people who have various disabilities or access issues, homebound customers. So we have a service where people who, through no fault of their own, it might be illness, it might be permanent disability, are permanently stuck at home, and we have a group of our specialised staff who work to develop volunteers who deliver pre-packaged and pre-curated packages of books for these customers, which we deliver to their homes and pick up what they have been reading and return to the library.
That's really great. So much like libraries often provide access to technology, technology also seems to be making libraries more accessible through things like ebooks or audiobooks. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the idea of like a technologically advanced library and what that might look like and what the future of libraries might look like.
Yeah, I mean, we as a leadership team, we're often discussing what future opportunities we might be able to provide to customers. And in terms of a technological library, that's kind of predicated on the basis that we would have a site full of technology and people would come and use that technology. And at the moment, several of our libraries have things like 3D printers that people can come and use. We have some sound recording suites where people can record some music or record oral histories. I think there's other players out there, Felix, that over time are in a better position to be able to deliver a huge amount of high-tech and often fairly expensive technology. I think we think libraries' role is more about helping people who have technology to be able to connect with each other and to be able to access some of the cool stuff that we have.
That was Daryl Soljan, Auckland's Head of Community Libraries North and West. Cheers to him for talking to me. It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Indeed, you're still on The Wire, and I just wanted to say apologies for earlier double-pressing the buttons, which made the sting cut out shortly. Anyway, we'll get back into it, and I think I'm doing all right. Thank you, Felix, for that report. We're going to move now on to New Zealand First.
It's time for Deputy Leader Fletcher Tabateau from the New Zealand First Party.
It's not Fletcher Tabateau, though. We're going to have to update this sting back to our Tracy Martin sting. Minister Tracy Martin joins us this week and will be joining us ongoing, thanks to the brilliant wrangling of News Director Jemima. Thank you for this. We haven't spoken to Tracy for a while, and not since lockdown. She told me she hadn't spent that much time with her family in a very long time, so that was lovely. We had a big chat and we touched on World Elder Abuse Day, which was earlier this week. You'll hear that part of the conversation on The Wire tomorrow. Today, though, we had an extensive conversation about systemic racism in Crown institutions after the announcement of a possible Māori health authority. I started by asking Tracy what New Zealand First thinks about this authority.
Yeah, so I'd seen the report and read through the report, I don't know, about a fortnight beforehand, and New Zealand First absolutely agrees that the current model of delivery through the DHB system is not working for New Zealand. It's postcode health often. We also know that taxpayers put billions upon billions of dollars into these DHBs, and we don't have enough visibility over where that money is being spent and the current structure of things. So we agree that there needs to be a major overhaul.
Mm.
The diagram on page 44 of the large document is probably the bit where we start to move away from our coalition partners. The independent Māori health organisation, we have a problem with when we decide we're going to run parallel pathways. To us, what's our constant concern is that we start to run a segregated system or a separatist system. You cannot get away from the stats around Māori health. You just can't. So it certainly needs to be a part of that overarching new health body, does need to be completely focused on Māori health. And then you need another one, we would suggest, for Pacifica Health. but we don't want to see them run as parallel organisations. We would much rather see an overarching and then have those specific units inside the overarching health organisation.
You know, if you're using the word separatism or segregated, you're sort of automatically going to imply that that is the case, as opposed to having a more targeted or focused approach and therefore authority that, that does deal with particular issues.
Well, I keep referring to page 44 because it's got a visual there of what this looks like. They are completely separate. So, the reality is that if you set up two completely separate organisations, you are going to run parallel pathways or separate pathways. What we're saying is, and we've always said it, you know, New Zealand is a diverse nation that has multiple different ethnicities in it. But our Indigenous people, obviously, we have a treaty and they have a special place. So our argument is we're one nation with different peoples. So the organisation that is delivering health needs to be one organisation, but with targeted units inside of it, so that we don't lose sight of what are, one, delivery methods that are different, because we all agree nobody's, one size doesn't fit all. But we don't want to start saying, well, actually, you're Māori, so you've got to go over there, and you're Pākehā, so you've got to go over there, or you're, Sri Lankan, and you've got to go over there.
So what the review was showing, my understanding of what the review shows, is that it is dealing with systemic racism, and that is the response to that. So does New Zealand First acknowledge that systemic racism is an issue?
So I think this is really good, because the word, this phrase, systemic racism, is just thrown about. So let's just diagnose what that actually is, shall we? The structures that we have in place, if I take the Parliament, it's the Westminster system. The structures that we have in place for government have come from Mother England. So that's just a reality. If we want to tag it and say it's systemic racism, it came from a system that believed that Mother England's way of doing things, which was obviously European, was the right way to do things. And that's just not the case. It made a decision that Indigenous ways of doing things were obviously wrong and that the European way of doing things was obviously right. That is not the case. So if that is systemic racism, absolutely agree. But it actually doesn't help us to just keep shouting that out. Why don't we just actually talk about the fact that we have inherited a system from the people that came and colonised this nation? We didn't take enough of an account of what were the Indigenous practices at the time. And we now need to just take a stock as a grown-up country, have a look at the Indigenous practices that should have been looked at then, and how can we start to adopt those things that will do better for us and keep those things that do well for us now. It's not about throwing one thing out and starting all over again.
Well, to rebut that, there's lots of people that are having those conversations about, we look at the world right now, we're talking about systems that are failing people, fatally actually, and if, as it comes down to Māori health stats, like you've said, you cannot ignore them. And if you go back to, like you said, the treaty partnership or the treaty relationship that exists, it's been found by the Waitangi Tribunal that Māori did not cede sovereignty. So actually, no, there was no agreement by Māori that system was better. And what Māori are saying now, they want to be able to implement their own systems through their own authority.
Yeah, I didn't say that Māori had agreed to it. I said it's what we inherited. So that's the first thing. The second thing is with regard, I'm not going to get into a sovereignty conversation actually, but let's take this conversation into Oranga Tamariki, okay? Because what we've got is the same statement being made about Oranga Tamariki. It's being made about every government department. Why? Because we inherited a Westminster system from Mother England. So if I can just talk to you for a moment about Pūʻau Te Atatū, all right?
Yep.
So in Pūʻau Te Atatū, there is a statement in there that says that hapū will decide where the child should reside, and that decision will override all parental rights. Now, just absorb that statement for a minute. And then you've got what is current law based on the Westminster system, which actually through, you know, through the ages treated children like property. So the current law and the current structures of, you know, whether it be the Aranga Tamariki Act or whether it be the Family Court Act or whatever, actually still see and still treat children as if they are the belongings of their parents. Go back to the Pu'ol Te Atatū statement. Hapū will decide where the child will reside, and that decision will override all parental rights. That's the conversation, that's a nub of a conversation that needs to take place with New Zealand. Our parents, are we as a nation prepared to shift from what is children being treated as property rights to children actually belonging to all of us, not just their parents, but being the future of their hapū and of their tribe, and so therefore others are part of the vital decision-making about the well-being of their children? That's the conversation I'm trying to have in this conversation you just talked about, to shift what has been, it's been systematically a system that has disadvantaged Māori a hell of a lot longer than I've been sitting in this seat, Lillian.
I can't really go away from the fact that that is then systematic racism.
I'm fine to call it that. It doesn't help. I mean, I absolutely have no problem with that being what people call it. I don't. It just doesn't help. It's like walking into a room and saying to a person you're a racist. You absolutely just shut down all conversation then, because you've just, you know, it's throwing that word onto the table. It doesn't create a constructive environment. That's where I'm going.
Right? You've said, though, that you don't want to have a conversation around sovereignty, but ultimately this is what this conversation is about, right? This is what we've had. We're hearing calls from Māori who are actually saying this is not working, and we want to be the ones to do this. Right? So, yes, let's have the Oranga Tamariki conversation, right? We've got this report that's come out from the Children Commissioner last week that again, has detailed incredibly traumatic uplift processes. So I guess, ultimately, do you stand by those processes?
No. And that's the very reason I'm in the job. That's the very reason the Prime Minister gave me the job, was to change those processes.
So why are they still happening?
I'll tell you why, Lillian. Because Oranga Tamariki was formed on the 17th of April 2017. And when when the organisation got formed, you can't go out there and fire 4,000 social workers and say, right, we're just going to fire all your front line and hire all brand new people from somewhere, and we're going to completely, and we're going to leave the children just to fend for themselves for a period of time while we do that, right? You can't do that. I speak to Jean Tahuia, John Tamahiri, and I were on the phone on Friday night. Dame Tiriana and I have had conversations. Mirapeka Rakawa Tate and I have conversations. They know exactly where I'm trying to get to. But if this has been developed, if the circumstances that we're in now are a side effect from something that happened in 1840 or before, I cannot turn it around in 2.5 years. I cannot. I have made huge strides in the way that we are working with iwi and hapū to actually devolve this system so that we get in earlier and prevention and early intervention. But I can't do it in 2.5 years. And no story of a baby uplift is going to be pleasant. I tell you that right now. Regardless of the ethnic background of the mother, if you are in a circumstance where somebody has said, I'm sorry, darling, but we are coming to take your baby away because your baby's not safe, that is, none of that is going to be pleasant.
Again, okay, acknowledging it's been 2.5 years since this organisation changed, but okay, so what has changed in those 2.5 years?
Okay. So first of all, last year on the 1st of July 2019, I managed to convince Cabinet to invest $1.1 billion into the operating model to change the way that the whole of the system works. So that was about prevention, early intervention, intensive intervention, care, youth justice and transition. The other thing I want to say too is that we've got, 6,400 children in the care of the state. of those children, 80% of them are still living with their families. So there's a misunderstanding that when somebody says that child's in the care of the state, that there's an assumption that they've been taken and put into an institution. And that is just not the case. 80% of these children are still living, some of them with mum and dad, but with the oversight of a social worker. Some of them with auntie, uncle, or granny or granddad, you know, but they're connected to a social worker because those children have been deemed by the family court that they are at risk. But so they're not all away from their families. We've actually lowered the number of babies that have been taken into the care of the state because we've been able to work earlier in partnerships with, we've now got 7 strategic partnerships with iwi throughout New Zealand. I talk more often to the heads of the iwi organisations, and we're trying to build their capacity so that they are able to step in earlier for their families, so that we don't get to this crisis place where a child has to be removed. Mm.
At what point do you see that happening? You know, is there some kind of time frame that you're working to?
Well, it's variable because it varies on, like, different iwi, different hapu, different Māori organisations. And can I just make sure that we understand 40% of the children that are in the care of the state are Pākehā? So we are talking about 60% of the children, and we're very focused on it. I understand that. But I don't want to lose sight that there's actually other families of other ethnic backgrounds that are also having really hard times because their children have been taken into the care of the state. Mm. So let's not forget that the system must actually be able to cater for all New Zealanders, but at the moment we have a major focus for Māori. And when do I see that happening? Lillian, I've got, I don't know if I'm going to be back in this job afterwards. I can only set in place, as much as I can set in place, to try and hope that this change, this devolving, the delivery of what was the vision of Po Aotearoa and Mātua Whāngai continues if I'm not here, which is why I talk to Alfred Nadu, which is why I try to make sure that there are others who know exactly what's going on in this portfolio, so if they end up sitting here, they can carry on down this pathway to actually do better by our children and our families.
Mm. Yeah, and I appreciate your point around those other children that are also in the system. I don't think anybody is ignoring the fact that this is a widespread issue. It more just going back to the fact that Māori are far more likely to be uplifted than non-Māori. So there is that issue. I think back to the fundamental point around, and it is a question of sovereignty again, but that the possibility which has been presented now by the government in the sense that there is going to be a Māori Health Authority. If this was ever a possibility that there be a Māori child, you know, authority, would you support that?
Well, are you talking apartheid?
No, I'm not talking apartheid. I'm talking about the Te Tiriti o Waitangi, which was ultimately agreed to, where Kāwanatanga did look after those that were subjects of the Crown, and then Rangatiratanga were those that looked after Māori. Now, you're right, we are in a different place in our society, but what we're seeing is that this authority, the Crown authority, is not working. And yes, there are changes being made, but if there were to be an authority that actually worked or operated under kaupapa Māori values, and that actually worked better for all tamariki of Aotearoa, would you stand by that?
Well, so I've got a couple of issues. First of all, I've actually asked iwi leaders, do you want me to hand over to you? Do you want me to get the courts to make you what's called a 396 provider? That means if any child that is of your particular iwi descent comes up, any family is in a circumstance where we need to go and actually remove that child, would you like me to make the courts you, the body that does it? And the answer has been no. So the answer's been no, or the answer's been not yet, because they're not ready. At the end of the day, I would prefer that Orangatamariki be an incredibly small unit, knowing that there are still orphans whose parents die, knowing that there are still situations where Orangatamariki, we've lost 3 children already this year who've been murdered by people who are supposed to love them. Last year we lost 11. So and Orangatamariki didn't kill them, Lillian. And we are the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. So in the first instance, We are offering, and we will build the capacity of Māori organisations. But for me to turn around tomorrow and just say, here you go, you look after your own children, would be setting them up to fail. And that is not what I want either. With regard to, I'm going to take exception. If we all agree that one size doesn't fit all, then the statement you just made, that is that a system that is based on Māori kaupapa will then be able to provide for all, how do those two statements go together?
That's you know, interesting point. And in terms of acknowledging, right, that this is it's a COPA, but perhaps it's more of the methodology if you reference it in a research setting. But in terms of the way that we operate in the world, it's an understanding of a particular way of being in the world. And that doesn't mean that it is one size fits all. It just means that there are some overarching values that you may operate by.
And I agree. I mean, you know, I don't know if you're aware of my background or not, but my mum was whānau, right? So I'm connected to Ngāti Kahununu down in the Hawke's Bay. So I grew up, you know, on and off marae, raised by my nanny. Mm. So I understand what you mean. And an example of that would be, but this is an example of what happens inside the... This is an example of what happens when humans get involved in what's a really good idea. Whānau Order, for example, is not a government department. Whānau Order is not a commissioning agency. Whānau Order is a way of being. Whānau Order basically means, and this is coming straight from Nader Glavish and the conversations that I had with Nader Glavish, Whānau Order is a holistic way of delivering to a family, to a person, what they need to be well. Now, that's what we need to shift to. In almost every problem that we've got, there are five major reasons how children come into the care of Oranga Tamariki. Family violence. 90 to 95% of the children currently in the care of Oranga Tamariki have experienced the trauma of family violence. Family violence, mental health, alcoholism, drug addiction. These are all the reasons that those children end up, those are the major reasons that children end up in the care of Oranga Tamariki. Not a single one of those things Oranga Tamariki can fix. Those are other government departments. That's why the solution to the what is the Oranga Tamariki problem is actually whānau ora from government, right? And so that's why I am one of the lead ministers on the Child and Youth Wellbeing Strategy, because that's my avenue and my lever with the Prime Minister to start working in that early intervention and prevention space, empowering community to offer help rather than waiting for people to be in a crisis and screaming out for help. Mm. So that's my vision for where we need to take this to, Lillian. And, you know, I mean, I know how much more time I've got here, but that's what I keep articulating on a daily basis, both to government departments and to anybody that'll listen, really.
That was Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. The Wire.
That was indeed Tracy Martin from the New Zealand First Party. We found the right sting there to take us out. We're going to go to some ads and we'll be back with the end of the show.
Can you imagine the world before coffee?
I'll tell you what, I'm two coffees deep right now and I'm still having trouble imagining the world. There's just so many bits in it. You know, it's just hard to keep it all in your head.
Maybe you have another coffee and try again.
Imagine Auckland before coffee. Thanks to Atomic Coffee Roasters, you don't have to. Auckland's original coffee roasters and your local since 1992. Swing by their Kingsland-based cafe and roastery or shop online at atomiccoffee.co.nz.
Just when you thought you heard all the music, there's only bloody more of it. 95 BFM Fancy New Band Showcase. Your future local legends all together in one night for your listening pleasure. With Crap Date, Deb 5000, Ripship, Fable, Dharma Rat, and The Elegant World. 95 BFM Fancy New Band Showcase 2020, June 26th, IRL at Whammy Bar. Streaming video online and broadcast on 95 BFM for the people at home. Thanks to NZ On Air Music.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
That was The Wire.
That was indeed The Wire for Wednesday the 17th of June. It's good to be back. Good to be back on here. That is the end of our show. Thank you to all of those who spoke with us for the show today. Daryl Soljan, Tracy Martin and Alan Blackman, of course. Thank you to Felix for his fabulous content. And thank you to all of you who were listening. Thank you to all of you who tuned in and rang in and texted in. We'll be back next week, of course. Up next is Bridge with the 1-4, and you are listening to 95 BFM. I'm going to leave the show with this track, which is a recording of the audio from a spoken word group, Ngahine Pu Kōrero. I believe they're sort of just out of high school age, and they performed at the BLM march on Sunday in Aotea Square. I'll leave that to finish up the show. Talk next week.
Tēnā tātou kua huhui mai nei ki te tautoko I te kaupapa kotahi kia whapai mō ngā oranga o ngā tangata kiriuri. We are Ngāhine Pū Kōrero, and we are a spoken word group that talk about Māori injustice as well as other political issues going on within our country. We are here to show support for the Black Lives Matter movement, and the poem that we are about to share with you talks about the importance of our voices as well as the importance of our language, that our Māori. So I hope you get to take something away from this piece. Ngā mihi.
Te reo Māori is the native language of our country, passed down from generation to generation. Over a single century, it almost vanished from a law that suppressed the sound of it in schools. Kids were bruised by their teachers' knuckles for speaking it on the playground. This was their way of delivering us from our wayward state.
They viewed our language as the head of a snake. Deemed useless because it wasn't written on paper. It wasn't long until we were forced to speak
in silence. Our kaumātua,
no,
grandparents,
lives were stained in blues and purples, English fingers slithering around their necks,
subdued until their sentences were laced with shame,
choking on blood and pride.
I can hear their screams.
I've never heard them speak. Nowadays, being fluent in Te Reo Māori is a privilege.
I've been told how lucky I am to have it as my first language.
Speak patterns into the air. Over time, it has lost its ability to fly. Language separated from tongue like root from tree.
So we tuck tarakeke.
No! Flax!
Into our cheeks.
Set the fibres between our teeth.
Let them knit together in our breath.
For if I stay silent, my tupuna.
No! Ancestors
will find a way to pry my jaws open.
My nana couldn't speak. She was beaten until her jaw was broken.
Use the pieces to raise our family. I speak teachings of broken bones because no one else in my family could. So tell us to be quiet and we'll breathe life into ancestors we haven't met.
Tell stories of a past submerged in bleach.
Legacy lives on in our voices. You can't take them away from us.
I hate forgetting.
Had to teach myself the prayers.
No.
Karakia, my parents didn't learn.
Had to overpronounce my words so the condensed history within each syllable is heard.
We learned not to forget, but to hide in our whispers.
Keeping our culture alive in the bottom of our lungs.
We drowned our ill in the depths of our stomachs. Stitched it into our clothes.
So tell us to be quiet and know that we won't.
This is our language. We are reclaiming it. We will speak it because our bodies weren't built for silence. We will speak it until the very eardrums is bruised. We will speak it for every person that was beaten into silence. We will speak it for every person that was never taught. We will speak it. We will speak it. We will speak.
Mā tū tēnei reo e kawe.
Mā tōku arero, mā kupu o ku tūpuna e whakatīnana. Kia maumahara ai tō rātou nei matora. Kia koe rātou e koroheke tea. Kō wai koe ki te whānako I te pautāwha o mātou nei tūpuna. Patua kiri, re re a toto. Anei rā o āwhenua I mōrehure ahi. Hei te pō, hei te reo. Anei rā ngā whenua I mōrehure hui o ku tūpuna. Ki ngā kino o te Pākehā. Tēnei tōku reo. e haruruana i te whenua.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.